This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Two Boys Kissing. This is the author, David Levithan. This book is dedicated to Robert Levithan, Maddie Daly, and Michael Cart. For very different reasons, this novel would not exist without them. You can't know what it is like for us now. You will always be one step behind. Be thankful for that. You can't know what it was like for us then. You will always be one step ahead. Be thankful for that, too. Trust us. There is a nearly perfect balance between the past and the future. As we become the distant past, you become a future few of us would have imagined. It's hard to think of such things when you are busy dreaming or loving or screwing. The context falls away. We are a spirit burden you carry, like that of your grandparents, or the friends from your childhood who at some point moved away. We try to make it as light a burden as possible. And at the same time, when we see you, we cannot help but think of ourselves. We were once the ones who were dreaming and loving and screwing. We were once the ones who were living, and then we were the ones who were dying. We sewed ourselves a thread's width into your history. We were once like you, only our world wasn't like yours. You have no idea how close to death you came. A generation or two earlier, you might be here with us. We resent you. You astonish us. It's 8:07 on a Friday night, and right now Neil Kim is thinking of us. He is 15, and he is walking over to his boyfriend Peter's house. They have been going out for a year, and Neil starts by thinking about how long this seems. From the beginning, everyone has been telling him it won't last. But now, even if it doesn't last forever, it feels like it has lasted long enough to be meaningful. Peter's parents treat Neil like a second son, and while Neil's own parents are still alternately confused and distressed, they haven't barred any of the doors. Neil has 2 DVDs, 2 bottles of Diet Dr. Pepper, cookie dough, and a book of poems in his backpack. This, and Peter, is all it takes for him to feel profoundly lucky. But luck, we've learned, is actually part of an invisible equation. 2 blocks away from Peter's house, Neil gets a glimpse of this, and is struck by a feeling of deep, unnamed gratitude. He realizes that part of his good fortune is his place in history, and he thinks fleetingly of us, the ones who came before. We are not names or faces to him. We are an abstraction, a force. His gratitude is a rare thing. It is much more likely for a boy to feel thankful for the Diet Dr. Pepper than he is to feel thankful for being healthy and alive, for being able to walk to his boyfriend's house at age 15 without any doubt that this is the right thing to do. He has no idea how beautiful he is as he walks up that path and rings that doorbell. He has no idea how beautiful the ordinary becomes once it disappears. If you were a teenager now, it is unlikely that you knew us well. We are your shadow uncles, your angel godfathers, your mother's or your grandmother's best friend from college, the author of that book you found in the gay section of the library. We are characters in a Tony Kushner play, or names on a quilt that rarely gets taken out anymore. We are the ghosts of the remaining older generation. You know some of our songs. We do not want to haunt you too somberly. We do not want our legacy to be gravitas. You wouldn't want to live your life like that, and you won't want to be remembered like that, either. Your mistake would be to find our commonality in our dying. The living part mattered more. We taught you how to dance. It's true. Look at Tariq Johnson on the dance floor. Seriously, look at him. 6'3" tall, 180 pounds, all of which can be converted by the right clothes and the right song into a mass of heedless joy. The right hair helps, too. He treats his body like it's made of fireworks, each one timed to the beat. Is he dancing alone or dancing with everyone in the room? Here's the secret. It doesn't matter. He traveled for 2 hours to get to the city, and when it's all over, it will take him over 2 hours to get home. But it's worth it. Freedom isn't just about voting and marrying and kissing on the street, although all of these things are important. Freedom is also about what you will allow yourself to do. We watch Tariq when he's sitting in Spanish class, sketching imaginary maps in his notebook. We watch Tariq when he's sitting in the cafeteria, stealing glances at older boys. We watch Tariq as he lays the clothes on his bed, creating the outline of the person he's going to be tonight. We spent years doing these things. And this was what we looked forward to, the thing that Tariq looks forward to. This liberation. Music isn't much different now from what it was when we hit the dance floor. This means something. We found something universal. We bottled that desire, then released it into the airwaves. The sounds hit your body, and you move. We are in those particles that send you. We are in that music. Dance for us, Tariq. Feel us there in your freedom. It was an exquisite irony. Just when we stopped wanting to kill ourselves, we started to die. Just when we were feeling strength, it was taken from us. This should not happen to you. Adults can talk all they want about youth feeling invincible. Surely some of us had that bravado. But there was also the dark, inner voice telling us we were doomed. And then we were doomed. And then we weren't. You should never feel doomed. It's 8:43 on the same Friday night, and Cooper Riggs is nowhere. He's in his room, alone, and it feels like nowhere. He could be outside his room, surrounded by people, and it would still feel like nowhere. The world, in his eyes, is flat and dull. All sensation has been leaked from it, and instead its energy is running through the busy corridors of his mind, making angry, frustrated noise. He is sitting on his bed, and he is wrestling within himself, and ultimately the only thing he can think to do is go on the internet, because life there is just as flat as real life, without the expectations of real life. He is only 17, but online he can be 22, 15, 27, whatever the other person wants him to be. He has fake profiles, fake photos, fake stats, and fake histories. The conversations are largely fake, too, full of flirtation he'll never deliver on, small sparks that will never turn to fire. He will not admit it, but he is actually looking for the surprise of something genuine. He opens 7 sites at once, keeping his mind busy, tricking himself out of nowhere, even if it still feels like nowhere. He gets so lost in the search that nothing else seems to matter, and time becomes worthless, to be spent on worthless things. We know that some of you are still scared. We know that some of you are still silent. Just because it's better now doesn't mean that it's always good. Dreaming and loving and screwing, none of these are identities. Maybe when other people look at us, but not to ourselves. We are so much more complicated than that. We wish we could offer you a creation myth, an exact reason why you are the way you are, why when you read this sentence, you will know it's about you. But we don't know how it began. We barely understood the time that we knew. We gather the things we learned, and they don't nearly add up to fill the space of a life. You will miss the taste of Fruit Loops. You will miss the sound of traffic. You will miss your back against his. You will even miss him stealing the sheets. Do not ignore these things. We did not have the internet, but we had a network. We did not have websites, but we had sites where we wove our web. You could see it most in the cities. Even someone as young as Cooper, as young as Tariq, could find it. Piers and coffee shops, spots in the park, and bookstores where Wilde, Whitman, and Baldwin reigned as bastard kings. These were the safe harbors, even when we feared that being too open meant we were opening ourselves to attack. Our happiness had defiance, and our happiness had fear. Sometimes there was anonymity, and sometimes you were surrounded by friends and friends of friends. Either way, you were connected by your desires, by your defiance, by the simple, complicated fact of who you were. Outside of the cities, the connections were harder to see, the web thinner, the sites harder to find. But we were there. Even if we thought we were the only ones, we were there. There are few things that can make us quite as happy as a gay prom. Right now, 9:03 on that Friday night, we're in a town with the improbable name of Kindling. Surely the pioneers had a fiery death wish, or maybe it was just a tribute to the burning sticks that kept the settlers alive. Somewhere along the way, someone must have learned the third little pig's lesson, since the community center is built entirely of bricks. It's a dull, quiet building in a dull, quiet town, its architecture as beautiful as the word municipal. It is an unlikely place for a blue-haired boy and a pink-haired boy to meet. Kindling does not have enough gay kids to support a prom on its own, so tonight the cars drive in from far and wide. Some of the couples drive in together, laughing or fighting or sitting in their separate silences. Some of the boys drive in alone. They've snuck out of the house, or they're meeting friends at the community center, or they saw the listing online and decided at the last minute to go. There are boys in tuxedos, boys adorned with flowers, boys in torn hoodies, boys in ties as skinny as their jeans, boys in ironic taffeta gowns, boys in unironic taffeta gowns, boys in V-neck t-shirts, boys who feel awkward wearing dress shoes, and girls. Girls wearing all these things, driving to the same place. If we went to our proms, we went with girls. Some of us had a good time. Some of us looked back years later and wondered how we had managed to be so oblivious about who we really were. A few of us managed to go with each other, with our best female friends covering as our dates. We were invited to this ritual, but only if we maintained the storyline of our supervisors. It was more likely for Neil Armstrong to invite us to a prom on the moon than it was for us to go to a prom like the one being held in Kindling tonight. When we were in high school, hair existed on the bland spectrum of black, brown, orange, blonde, gray, white. But tonight in Kindling, we have Ryan walking into the community center with his hair dyed a robin's egg blue. 10 minutes later, Avery walks in with his hair the color of a Mary Kay Cadillac. Ryan's hair is spiked like the surface of a rocky ocean, while Avery's swoops gently over his eyes. Ryan is from Kindling, and Avery is from Marigold, a town 40 miles away. We can tell immediately that they've never met, and that they are going to. We are not unanimous about the hair. Some of us think it is ridiculous to have blue hair or pink hair. Others of us wish we could go back and make our hair mimic the jello our mothers would serve us in the afternoon. We are rarely unanimous about anything. Some of us loved, some of us couldn't. Some of us were loved, some of us weren't. Some of us never understood what the fuss was about. Some of us wanted it so badly that we died trying. Some of us swear we died of heartbreak, not AIDS. Ryan walks into the prom, and then Avery walks in 10 minutes later. We know what's going to happen. We have witnessed this scene so many times before. We just don't know if it will work, or if it will last. We think of the boys we kissed, the boys we screwed, the boys we loved, the boys who didn't love us back, the boys who are with us at the end, the boys who are with us beyond the end. Love is so painful. How could you ever wish it on anybody? And love is so essential. How could you ever stand in its way? Ryan and Avery do not see us. They do not know us, or need us, or feel us in the room. They don't even see each other until about 20 minutes into the prom. Ryan sees Avery over the head of a 13-year-old boy in, it's true, so gay, rainbow suspenders. He spots Avery's hair first, then Avery. And Avery looks up at just that moment and sees the blue-haired boy glancing his way. Some of us applaud. Others look away because it hurts too much. We always underestimated our own participation in magic. That is, we thought of magic as something that existed with or without us. But that's not true. Things are not magical because they've been conjured for us by some outside force. They are magical because we create them, and then deem them so. Ryan and Avery will say the first moment they spoke, the first moment they danced, was magical. But they were the ones, no one else, nothing else, who gave it the magic. We know. We were there. Ryan opened himself to it. Avery opened himself to it, and the act of opening was all they needed. That is the magic. Focus in. The blue-haired boy leads. He smiles as he takes the pink-haired boy's hand. He feels what we know. The supernatural is natural, and wonderment can come from the most mundane movement, like a heartbeat or a glance. The pink-haired boy is scared, so incredibly scared. Only the thing you've most wished for can scare you in that way. Hear their heartbeats. Listen close. Now draw back. See the other kids on the dance floor. The comfortable misfits, the torn rebels, the fearful and the brave. Dancing or not dancing, talking or not talking. But all in the same room. All in the same place, gathering together in a way they weren't allowed to do before. Draw back farther. We are standing in the eaves. Say hi if you see us. Silence equals death, we'd say. And underneath that would be the assumption, the fear, that death equaled silence. Sometimes you glimpse that horror. When someone close to you gets sick, when someone close to you gets sent to war, when someone close to you takes his or her own life. Every day, a new funeral. It was such a large part of our existence. Imagine being in a school where a student dies every day. Some of them your friends, some of them just kids who happen to be in your class. You keep showing up because you know you have to. You become the bearer of memory and also the bearer of sorrow until it is your turn to be the one who is gone, the one who is mourned. You have no idea how fast things can change. You have no idea how suddenly years can pass and lives can end. Ignorance is not bliss. Bliss is knowing the full meaning of what you have been given. It is 10:45. Craig Cole and Harry Ramirez are planning their big kiss. There have been months of preparation leading to this kiss, and now here they are, the night before. Most kisses only require two people, but this one will end up needing at least a dozen. None of those other people are in the room right now. It's just Craig and Harry. "Are we really going to do this?" Craig asks. "We most certainly are," Harry replies. They know they need their sleep. They know it's a big day tomorrow. They know there's no backing down, and also no guarantee that they'll make it. They should be going to sleep, but good company is the enemy of sleep. We remember this feeling so acutely, the desire to linger away the hours with someone else, talking or holding or even just watching a movie. In those moments, the clock seems arbitrary, since you were setting your understanding of time to another, more personal measure. They're at Harry's house. His parents are out for the night, the dog already asleep. Because the house feels theirs, the world feels theirs. Why would you want to close your eyes to that? They're at Harry's house because Craig's parents can't know about the kiss. At some point they will. But not now. Not before it's happened. Eventually Harry will leave Craig curled on the couch. He will tuck Craig in, then tiptoe back to his own room. They will be in separate places, but they will have very similar dreams. We miss the sensation of being tucked in, just as we miss the sensation of being that hovering angel, pulling the blanket over his shoulders, wishing him a sweet night. Those are the beds we want to remember. We are excited for the kiss tomorrow. We don't see how they can do it, but we are hoping they will. Pink-haired Avery was born a boy that the rest of the world saw as a girl. We can understand what that's like, to be seen as something that you are not. But for us, it was easier to hide. For Avery, there is a thicker chain of biology to break. At a young age, his parents realized what was wrong. His mother thought that maybe she'd always known, which was why she'd chosen the name Avery, her father's name, which was going to be given to the baby, whether it was a boy or a girl. With his parents' help and blessing, if not always comprehension, Avery charted a new life, was driven many miles, not to dance or drink, but to get the hormones that would set his body in the right direction. And it's worked. We look at Avery now and know it's worked, and appreciate the marvel of it. In our day, he would have been trapped by an insurmountable body in an intractable world. As they're dancing, Avery wonders if Ryan realizes, and worries that Ryan will care. The blue-haired boy sees him, this is for sure. But does he see everything, or only what he wants to be seeing? This is always one of the great questions of love. Ryan is more worried by time and what to do about time. He cannot believe he's found someone here in the bowels of the Kindling Community Center, the same place he learned to swim, the same place he took rec league basketball when he was 9, the same place he's staffed bake sales and blood drives, and the same place he'll vote when he's old enough to vote. Yes, it's also the same place he ducked out of to have his first cigarette and, a couple of years later, his first joint. But it's never been somewhere he would have imagined finding a pink-haired boy to dance with. He can sense his friends watching from the sidelines, whispering about what will happen next. This only amplifies his own need to know. Time's running out, but what is it running toward? Should he stop and talk to this boy more, before the DJ plays the last song and the lights come back on? Or should they stay like this, paired by the music, cocooned in a song? "Talk to him," we want to say. Because, yes, time can be buoyed by wordlessness, but it needs to be anchored in words. We know what their best chance is, and in this, the DJ does not disappoint. As most DJs will at some point in an evening, he spins a song that means a lot to him and nothing to anyone else present. Within seconds, the floor starts to clear. Conversations rise from a buzz to a clamor. A line forms at the men's room. Both Avery and Ryan stop. Neither wants to leave if the other wants to stay. Finally, Avery says, "I can't see any way to dance this song." And Ryan says, "Do you want to get some water?" An escape is made. The DJ opens his eyes and sees what he's done. By all rights, he should switch the song. But it's a long-distance dedication to the boy he loves down in Texas. He dials up the boy right now and holds his phone into the air. Not all songs need to be for dancing. There will always be the next song to draw the dancers back. This is what happens when you become very ill. Dancing stops being a reality and becomes a metaphor. More often than not, it is an unkind one. I am dancing as fast as I can. As if the disease is the fiddler who keeps playing faster and faster, and to lose step is to die. You try and try and try, until finally the fiddler wears you down. This is not the kind of dancing you want to remember. You want to remember a slow song like Avery and Ryan's Last Dance. You want to remember dancing as Tariq remembers dancing, as he heads home from his night at the club. It's only 11 at night, which is barely noon when you're on party time. But he promised Craig and Harry that he'd get some sleep, so he can be with them for the big kiss tomorrow without nodding off. It was hard for him to step away from the music, from the pulse it created. He tries to simulate it now by blasting music in his ears, ignoring the other sounds on the late-night suburban train. It's not the same, because there are no other boys to look at or be looked at by, just remnant commuters and some girls who've just seen some Broadway show. One of them tried to catch Tariq's eye earlier, and he just gave her a nice try, sorry, smile, sending her back into her playbill. If you close your eyes, you can conjure a world. Tariq closes his eyes and sees butterflies. The vibrancy of them spinning in the air to the music in his mind's eye. That's who he wants to be, on the dance floor and in life. A butterfly, colorful and soaring. There is something about the pureness of butterfly dreams, about all the things that dancing can unlock when you are young. When it works, that freedom doesn't stop when the last song is played. You take it with you. You use it for bigger things. You notice when it's taken away. Ryan and Avery can feel their words working with each other, can feel the simple joy of falling into the same rhythm, thinking companionable thoughts. Ryan's friend Alicia is giving him a ride home, and she is hovering on the periphery, shooting him a look every now and then. Ryan ignores this, because he and Avery are in their fortress of non-solitude, talking about how small their towns are and how strange it is to be at a gay prom. Ryan loves the way Avery's hair swoops, loves the shy curiosity in his eyes. Avery, meanwhile, keeps stealing peeks at the tip of Ryan's V-neck, his jeans, and his perfect hands. We remember what it was like to meet someone new. We remember what it was like to grant someone possibility. You look out from your own world, and then you step into his, not really knowing what you'll find there, but hoping it will be something good. Both Ryan and Avery are doing this. You step into his world, and you don't even realize your loneliness is missing. You left it behind, and you don't notice because you have no desire to turn back. You keep your eye on him. Perhaps because of the diet Dr. Pepper consumed earlier, Peter and Neil are up later than they expected to be. The date was a success, even though they've been together long enough that they don't even think of it as a date, just as a night together. They watched both movies in quick succession. Horror first, for Neil. Then romantic comedy, for Peter. With Neil holding himself back from smiling at Peter's fright during the horror, and his tears as the romantic comedy resolved itself in predictable romantic comedy fashion. Peter is still self-conscious about these things, and Neil is conscious of this self-consciousness, even if he can't always contain his amusement. "Are you all right?" he asked at a moment during the romantic comedy when Peter seemed particularly tense, and he couldn't help but squeeze Peter's arm with mock sympathy when Peter said, "I just want Emma Stone to be okay." Neither of their sets of parents are ready for sleepovers yet, so Neil left Peter's house a stroke before midnight, and now they are in their own rooms, in their own houses, talking to each other over the internet as they each get ready for bed. Every now and then, one of Neil's Korean relatives pops up in the Skype column. Neil is relieved that none of them attempt to say hi. Peter's connection is devoted solely to Neil, at least at this hour. Peter thinks there is nothing more adorable in the whole universe than the sight of Neil in his pajamas. They are proper pajamas, striped button-down shirt with matching striped elastic-waisted bottoms. They're at least a size too big and make him look like he's waiting for Mary Poppins to pop her head in and say, "It's time to go to bed." Peter is in boxers and a t-shirt that reads, "Legalize Gay." Even though they've just spent hours talking, they spend another hour talking, sometimes sitting at their computers and looking at each other, and other times letting the cams gaze on as they walk around their rooms, brush their teeth, pick out clothes for tomorrow. We envy such intimacy. There comes a point where Peter and Neil's conversation becomes too cloudy to continue. Even Diet Dr. Pepper wears off after a while. But their cloudiness is the white, puffy kind, the kind of clouds that little children imagine will carry them off to sleep. Peter wishes Neil sweet dreams, and Neil wishes the same thing back. Then, for just a moment, they wave to each other, smile. One last glimpse of pajamas, then good night. Eventually, we all must go to sleep. This is our first intimation that the body always wins. No matter how happy we are, no matter how much we want our night to stretch out infinitely, sleep is inevitable. You might be able to dodge it for one giddy cycle, but the body's need will always return. We used to fight it. Whether our allegiance was to talking in the dark or to dancing in the flashing lights, we wanted our nights to be endless. So the conversation could continue, so the dance could push on. We'd fill ourselves with coffee, with sugar, with stronger, more dangerous substances. But drowsiness would always tug at our tide and eventually turn it. We would playfully think of sleep as the enemy, the scourge. Why reside in the house of sleep when there was so much going on outside of it? And then the fight became more desperate. When you know you only have months left, days left, who wants to sleep? Only when the pain is too much. Only when you are desperate for the negation. Otherwise, sleep is time you've lost and are never getting back. But what a pleasant negation it is. Drifting over the land of sleep and dreams, we can see why insomniacs beg and dreamers lead. We watch Craig curled on Harry's lime green couch, under an afghan that Craig's great-grandmother crocheted. We watch Harry in his bedroom, his arms rounded and his hands beneath his head, his body a lowercase q. In another corner of the same town, Tariq has fallen asleep with headphones on, Icelandic music looping through his nighttime travels. In another town, Neil in his pajamas dreams that he and Peter are playing tic-tac-toe, while Peter in his t-shirt and boxers dreams that emperor penguins have taken over the local mall and are trying to sell sunglasses to Emma Stone. Back in a town called Marigold, Avery falls asleep with a phone number written on his hand, while in a town called Kindling, Ryan has taken a sleeping bag and has fallen asleep under the stars, smiling at the thought of a pink-haired boy and what they might do tomorrow. Only Cooper is still awake, but that won't last long. He types himself into other time zones, talks with men who are just waking up, men who are sneaking a moment from work. He deceives them all, but cannot deceive himself. He is still nowhere, and no matter how hard he looks, there is no somewhere to be found, especially inside of himself. He believes the world is full of stupid, desperate people, and he can only feel stupid and desperate to spend so much time with them. We are worried by this. We tell him to go to sleep. Everything is better after sleep. But he can't hear us. He goes on and on. His eyes start to close more and more. "Go to bed, Cooper," we whisper. "Go to your bed." He falls asleep at the computer. Men from other hours ask him if he's still there, if he's gone. Then they move on to newer windows, leaving Cooper's empty. He cannot notice when everyone else has left the room. This is an incomplete picture. There are boys lying awake, hating themselves. There are boys screwing for the right reasons and boys screwing for the wrong ones. There are boys sleeping on benches and under bridges, and luckier unlucky boys sleeping in shelters, which feel like safety, but not like home. There are boys so enraptured by love that they can't get their hearts to slow down enough to get some rest, and other boys so damaged by love that they can't stop picking at their pain. There are boys who clutch secrets at night in the same way they clutch denial in the day. There are boys who do not think of themselves at all when they dream. There are boys who will be woken in the night. There are boys who fall asleep with phones to their ears. And men. There are men who do all these things. And there are some men, fewer and fewer, who fall to bed and think of us. In their dreams, we are still by their side. In their nightmares, we're still dying. In the blurriness of night, they reach for us. They say our names in their sleep. To us, this is the most meaningful, most heartbreaking sound we ever had the privilege and misfortune to know. We whisper their names back to them, and in their dreams, maybe they hear. We wish we could show you the world as it sleeps. Then you'd never have any doubt about how similar, how trusting, how astounding and vulnerable we all are. We no longer sleep, and because we no longer sleep, we no longer dream. Instead, we watch. We don't want to miss a thing. You have become our dreaming. In the middle of the night, Harry's mother opens his door, checks that he's safely asleep. Then she heads to the den and does the same for Craig, smiling to see him wrapped in the afghan. She knows that they have a big day tomorrow, and she is worried for them. But she will only show her worry when they are asleep. Mostly, she is proud. Pride is allowed to have an element of worry, especially when you are a mother. Harry's mother tucks him in for a second time. She kisses him lightly on the forehead, then tiptoes from the room. We miss our mothers. We understand them so much more now. And those of us who had children miss our children. We watch them grow with sadness and amazement and fear. We have stepped away, but not entirely away. They know this. They sense it. We are no longer here, but we are not yet gone. And we will be like that for the rest of their lives. We watch, and they surprise us. We watch, and they surpass us. The music in Tariq's ears fades, the battery diminished. He doesn't notice. It is one of the body's greater gifts, the ability to prolong music long after it's faded from the air. Asleep in his backyard, Ryan does not notice the halo of dew that gathers around him as the night warms into morning. His eyes will open to a sparkle on the grass. The waking world. Even the most cynical among us must greet it with a touch of hope. Maybe it's a chemical reaction, our thoughts communing with the sunrise and creating that brief, intense faith in newness. We fall quiet as we watch the sun reach over the horizon. No matter where we are, no matter who we're watching, we pause. Sometimes we look to the distance to see the dawning of the day, and other times we witness it as it's reflected on the people we've come to care about, watch as the light spreads over their sleeping features. How can you not hope as the world, for an instant, glows gold? We, who can no longer feel, still feel it. The memory is so strong. Waking is hard, and waking is glorious. We watch as you stir, then as you stumble out of your beds. We know that gratitude is the last thing on your mind, but you should be grateful. You've made it to another day. Harry wakes up excited. Today is the day. After all the planning, after all the practice, this particular Saturday is no longer a square on the calendar. It is no longer a date talked about in future tense. It is a day arriving like any other day, but not feeling like any day that has come before. He goes straight from his bed to the kitchen, moppy hair askew, clothes sleep-worn, and finds his parents there, gearing up in their way for his day. His dad is making breakfast, and his mom is at the kitchen table, reading the crossword clues out loud so the puzzle can be filled in together. "We were just about to wake you," his mother says. Harry keeps walking to the den. Craig is sitting bolt upright on the couch, looking like the morning is a mathematical problem he needs to solve before he gets out of bed. "Dad's making French toast," Harry says, knowing the addition of food to the equation will help it get solved faster. Craig responds with something that sounds like, "Meh." Harry pats him on the foot and heads back to the kitchen. Tariq's alarm goes off, but he doesn't feel alarmed. With his headphones still dulling the outside noise, it sounds like there's music coming from the next room, and he takes it, slowly, as an invitation. As soon as Neil is out of the shower, he texts Peter. "You up?" he asks, and the reply comes instantly. "For anything." We smile at this, but then we look over to Cooper's house and we stop. He is still asleep at his desk, his face just barely glancing the keyboard, keeping the computer awake through the night. His father is coming into the room, and he doesn't look happy. All of Cooper's chat windows are still on the screen. We shiver in recognition at what's about to happen. We see it on his father's face. Who among us hasn't done what Cooper's just done? That one mistake, that stupid slip, the magazine left spread-eagled on the floor, the love notes hidden under the mattress, the most obvious place, the torn-out underwear ad folded into the dictionary, destined to fall out when the dictionary is opened, the doodles we should have burned, the writing of another boy's name over and over, over and over, the clothes shoved in the back of our closet, the book by James Baldwin sitting on our shelf wearing another book's jacket, Walt Whitman beneath our pillow, a snapshot of the boy we love, grinning, the conspiracy of us in his eyes, a snapshot of the boy we love who has no idea that we love him, captured oblivious, not knowing the camera was there, a snapshot we kept in our top desk drawer, in a fold in our wallet, in a pocket next to our heart. We should have remembered to take it out before throwing it in the laundry hamper. We should have known what would happen when our mother opened the drawer looking for a pencil. "He's just a friend," we'd argue. But if he was just a friend, why was he hidden? Why were we so upset to have him discovered? We want to wake Cooper up. We want to make the door louder as it opens. We want his father's footsteps to sound like thunder, but instead they sound like lightning. His father knows how to do this, his anger building quiet speed. He leans over his son and reads the remnants of last night's conversations. Some are merely conversational, a bored patois, What's up? Not much. You? Not much. But others are frank, sexual, explicit. Here's what I'd do to you. Is that the way you want it? We look closely, hoping for concern to spread over the father's face. Concern is okay. Concern is understandable. But we, who have looked so long for signs of concern in others, see only disgust, revulsion. Wake up, the father says. Anger, rage. When Cooper doesn't stir, he says it again and kicks Cooper's chair. That does it. Cooper jolts awake, his face pressing into the keyboard, creating an unsayable word. His contact lenses feel like dry wafers on his eyes. His breath tastes like morning worms. His father kicks his chair again. Is this what you do? Is the angry accusation. When we're asleep, is this what you're up to? Cooper doesn't understand at first. Then he raises his head, swallows the meager spit in his mouth, sees the screen. Quickly, he closes the laptop, but it's too late. Is this what you do in my house? Is this what you do to your mother and me? From a cold distance, we know that confusion is at the heart of this disgust, and into that heart is pumping a steady flow of hate and ignorance. We know that Cooper doesn't have a chance. His father grabs him by the shirt and pulls him up so he can be screamed at eye to eye. What are you? How could you do this? Cooper doesn't know. He doesn't know what to say. He doesn't know what to do. There aren't even answers. The father's face is burning red now. Do you just go off and fuck men? Is that it? While we're asleep, you go out and fuck them? No, Cooper finally says. No. Then what is this? A disgusted gesture to the closed computer. What kind of whore are you? Fuck. Whore. These are not words any son should hear from his father. But the father's rage has its own language. It does not have to talk like a father. Stop, Cooper whispers, tears filling his eyes. Just stop. But there is no stopping. Cooper's father pushes him against the wall. Impact. The wall shakes and things fall. Cooper is no longer nowhere. He is somewhere now. And it is a horror. It is everything he never wanted to happen. And it's happening. His mother comes running into the room. For a moment, we are grateful. For a moment, we think it will stop. But the father doesn't care. He keeps yelling, faggot, disgrace, whore, sick. What's going on? The mother yells. What's going on? Cooper cannot stop crying, which makes his father even angrier. And now his father is explaining to his mother, he sells himself to men on the internet. No, Cooper says, it's not like that at all. Open it, his father commands his mother. Read. Cooper actually lunges, tries to grab the laptop away, but his father knocks him back, pins him down as his mother opens the computer. The screen lights up. She begins to read. It's just chatting, Cooper tries to tell her. Nothing ever happens. But the look on her face as she reads, some of us have to turn away. We know that look. Something inside her is breaking. And in that breakage, she is giving up on us. There is nothing more painful than watching someone give up on you, especially if it's your mother. Some mothers recover from this moment. Some never do. And within the moment, the trouble is you can't know which way it will go. You see, the father says. A fuse in Cooper finally reaches the explosive core. Detonates. He has to stop this. He has to do something. He doesn't mean for it to be fighting back, although later it will look like fighting back. All he wants is for his mother to stop reading. So he jumps for the computer, tears it from her hands. In surprise, she recoils, and his father is too unprepared to catch him. But even though Cooper's gotten it out of her hands, it won't stay in his. He fumbles, and the laptop goes crashing to the floor, making a terrible sound. He reaches down and picks it up, but now his father is on him, pulling at his back, spinning him around. Cooper knows the blow is coming, and he lifts the laptop to block it. His father's fist is too fast, and it slams into his cheek before he can get the laptop up. No, his mother cries out. She gets in between them. She will do that much. Cooper doesn't hesitate. His keys and his phone are in his pocket. So he runs. He runs out of the room as his father rages behind him, raging at his mother. He runs out the front door, runs to his car. He sees his parents coming after him, hears his father screaming, but doesn't understand the words. When he turns the car on, the music blasts. He doesn't check to see if any cars are coming as he pulls out of the driveway, even though he knows this will only piss off his father more. It only takes him 10 seconds to leave his parents. Besides strangers, they are now the only people in the world who know he's gay. You spend so much time, so much effort, trying to hold yourself together, and then everything falls apart anyway. In the time it takes for all of this to happen, Tariq takes a shower. In the time it takes for all of this to happen, Craig, admittedly a slow eater, eats a piece of French toast. In the time it takes for all of this to happen, Peter loads up a video game and starts to play. In the time it takes for all of this to happen, Avery wakes to find a phone number still written on his hand and wonders what to do next. He doesn't have to worry, though. Ryan is already on it. He has Avery's number in his phone, and as soon as the clock hits 10, he's going to call. He feels it's rude to call anyone before 10, so he waits. Impatiently, he waits. It's funny the things you miss, like phone cords. Reading this today, you might not even know what a phone cord is. Or it's a relic that you see in an office, or on that antique phone in the corner of the classroom, used to call the principal's secretary. But once upon a time, that would be our time, a telephone cord seemed like nothing less than a lifeline. It was your attachment to the outside world, and even more than that, your attachment to the people you loved, or wanted to love, or tried to love. Everything about it was fitting. The way it curled in on itself, the way it got so easily tangled, the way you could pull it only so far before it kept you in place. Twisted and knotted and essential, it kept us tethered to each other, tethered to all the questions and some of the answers, tethered to the idea that we could be somewhere other than our rooms, our homes, our towns. We couldn't escape, but our voices could travel. When the phone didn't ring, it mocked us. When the phone rang, we clutched at it, grateful. At precisely 10 o'clock, Avery's phone rings. Avery doesn't recognize the number, then checks it against his hand. "Hello?" he says. "Hi," Ryan says, as happy to be heard as Avery is happy to hear him. They begin to make plans, and a plan. Plans are the things you are going to do at a precise time, while a plan is the more general idea of all the things you might do together. Plans are the coordinates. A plan is the entire map. Plans are the things you can discuss in that first nervous phone call. A plan is the thing that goes unsaid, but puts the hope in your voice nonetheless. While Avery and Ryan figure out what they are going to do today, the word together becomes the plan underlying the plans. Avery knows his parents will give him the keys to the car again, so he volunteers to return to Kindling to see what it has to offer. Ryan tells him it isn't very much, but Avery is experienced enough in his flirtations to say that as long as Ryan is there, it will be enough. When Avery hangs up the phone, he smiles. When Ryan hangs up the phone, he panics. Buoyant objects still exert pressure. Ryan wants to clean his room, clean his hair, clean his life, clean his town all at once. Avery, meanwhile, smiles his way to the shower. There are things for him to worry about, too, for sure. But those beasts are polite enough to wait at the gate until he makes his preparations. There is nothing so heartening as a chance. You will never forget what that feels like. That hope. Yes, we could talk to you for days on end about all the bad first dates. Those are stories. Funny stories, awkward stories, stories we love to share, because by sharing them, we get something out of the hour or two we wasted on the wrong person. But that's all bad first dates are, short stories. Good first dates are more than short stories. They are first chapters. On a good first date, everything is springtime. And when a good first date becomes a good relationship, the springtime lingers. Even after it's over, there can be springtime. A lot of thought has gone into the location of Craig and Harry's kiss. If convenience had been the deciding factor, the obvious choice would have been to do it in Harry's house, or in his backyard. The Ramirezes would have been more than okay with this, and would have made all the arrangements that needed to be made. But Craig and Harry didn't want to hide it away. The meaning of this kiss would come from sharing it with other people. It was Craig who suggested the lawn in front of their high school. It was public, but also familiar. The school itself was usually open on weekends for one reason or another. A football game, play practice, a debate tournament. But on the lawn, they wouldn't be in anyone's way. There was plenty of access to water and electricity, and their friends would know where to find them. They debated over whether to ask permission. Harry's parents insisted on it. Harry and Craig made an appointment with the principal and explained their kiss to her. She was sympathetic, almost surprisingly so. She gave her permission, but warned them that there were still risks. They accepted that. Now, here they are, pulling into the empty high school parking lot. Football won't happen until tomorrow, and play practice doesn't begin until 2. The building has earned its indifference on this Saturday morning. It has seen many worse things than two boys kissing. Smitta, Craig's best friend, is already there waiting. She thinks Harry and Craig are crazy for doing this, and that of the two of them, Craig is the crazier one. Because, she thinks with only mild hyperbole, his parents are going to kill him. And if his parents don't, maybe kissing Harry will. Because when it all comes down to it, the breakup was much easier for Harry than it was for Craig. In Smitta's eyes, Harry got off easy. He got to feel it was mutual. And then he got to go on with his life while Craig spent the next year still in love with him. Okay, maybe not a full year. Smitta isn't very good with relationship math. Who is? The point is, it was long enough. Too long. And even though Craig tells her up and down and back again that he's totally over Harry, that they're just friends now, and even though she's learned not to contradict him out loud, just to lay the groundwork so he can come to her later when he realizes he's wrong, Smitta still thinks this whole plan is stupendously tone-deaf when it comes to what's really inside Craig's heart. We have heard her confess this to her sister, and her sister has been sympathetic. Smitta understands that there are bigger issues here, at least when it comes to the statement Harry and Craig are making. If you were to ask her under what possible circumstances would it be okay for Craig to kiss Harry again, she guesses this would be one of the few acceptable answers. She told them she thought it was crazy when they first told her about it. She thinks she was the first person they told, but really she was the second. And once they told her they were totally okay with it being crazy, what else could she say? She would always be on Craig's side, no matter what. And if that meant helping them research and fill out paperwork and plan for this absurd feat of political statement and potential heart endangerment, so be it. With the precision of the doctor she will no doubt one day become, she worked with them to plot out the best possible strategy for maximum endurance. This meant countless hours of watching YouTube videos of people kissing for very long periods of time. It was the strangest homework she'd ever done. But her regular homework was already completed. What else did she have to do? Now here she is, and here they are, and now it's closing in on the starting time. Once they start kissing, they will have to keep kissing for at least 32 hours, 12 minutes, and 10 seconds. That is 1 second longer than the current world record for the longest recorded kiss. The reason they are all here is to break that record. And the reason they want to break that record started with something that happened to Tariq. We watch as he pulls into the parking lot. We watch as he sees them gathering,